You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. And today I'm talking to someone who knows the ups and downs of comedy stardom from the inside out. This conversation was recorded live at the Gilded Balloon in Edinburgh, and it is, of course, the very funny and very lovely Jason Manford. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. No pressure to be funny, that's funny.
Yeah, there isn't. What normally
I
happens...
I say that, but just the fact you're on stage and there's an audience and lights,
yeah,
that's its own pressure.
You know, yeah, I mean? Well, absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah, already, I'm like... Even this far with no joke, I'm dying on my arse. It's weird.
You're the first person that's pointed that out immediately. Several of my guests have got about 15 minutes in and just gone, is this all right?
It's really weird. Yeah.
There is a pressure, isn't there?
Yeah,
there's a pressure.
Yeah, of course. It's
yeah.
You've just drummed into yourself. Like, you know, it's just weird.
So I saw your show last night here at
all
the
right,
festival.
Yeah.
Was that your first night last night?
Second night.
It was your second.
Yeah,
How's the show going up here? We'll just sort of put you in context.
This year. This time round, it's easy in a way, like because I'm in the middle of a tour. Mm-hmm. So previously, I've written a show especially for Edinburgh, and off the back of Edinburgh, you tour it and off you go. Whereas this year, I was touring anyway, mm-hmm. and Edinburgh just makes sense to come and do the festival.
Okay.
In the middle of it, the weirdest thing I think is that your tour is, well, my tour I do 2 hours roughly, and obviously this is an hour, so
sure.
It's basically what you get to see what your DVD will look like. So okay. You just sort of get rid of all the crap and then just give them the solid hour. They go, well, that's good. I might go and see him on tour and see what the full show is. I go, no, don't do that. You've seen the best as it can be.
So and whereabouts in the life of the tour is this show? Are you about to go? Finishing it off?
Well, I tour, like I do massive tours. Like I don't, I go everywhere. Like I get them to sort of, Put it all in, and then I get the map. We get a map at Phil McIntyre's, who've done all my tours, and we get the map, and we put a pin in all the places that we're doing, a little mark, and then we do like a radius of like 30 miles around every pin, and then colour it all in, and then we have a look, where's any green left?
Do you actually do that? That's incredible.
And then I see where I've not played, and I go, right, let's get to mark 8.
Okay.
And then...
And what drives that? Why do you do that in particular? Is it some... Is it a sort of an egocentric desire to be known by everyone throughout the country, or is it just that you want to?
No, because
you want to tick it off, or where's that?
Because,
come from?
Because people love moaning, and if you don't come near their house, they like proper moan at you. You know, you're just like I'm trying my best. Peter Kay didn't even leave Manchester for his tour. He literally called it the tour that didn't tour. Mine's the tour that tours like fuck.
Yeah,
and I go everywhere. You know, so I don't know. I sort of also it's your job. You know, it's just it's your job, you know what I mean? You've got a tour, and so I just try and get most places, and you know, it's hard when you get down towards like Cornwall and places like that and stuff. Let me just turn this off. Sorry, I turned that on before. And I think when you get down to those places, you know, there's not as many gigs to do, you know, and I just try my best to cover as much ground as possible. So I think I'm doing about 148 dates, I think, on this tour.
Okay. What the recording might not pick up is certain members of the audience going, I just did that. That is big. That's a big tour.
And I think it's, I don't know. I just always have. I've always, I can't believe my luck. I think that's what it is. There's an element of that of just going, can I come there and you'll come to my show? Okay.
You know, now, you had, talk about not believing your luck. You had quite an interesting start in comedy. You had something I talk about a lot on this show is people's origin stories, comics as superheroes. Your origin story is quite unusual. You were collecting glasses at the Buzz Club.
Yeah. It's one of those stories now, of course, like 16 years later that I go, I wish I'd have had a boring one. Because it is radio interview, I'm not having to go at you, like, I'm just saying every radio interview goes, oh, you've had an interesting start. But it is, I mean, I suppose it is very interesting in that respect, in the sense that there's a point where you think stand-up is, well, maybe not now, but certainly when I started, where you just think it's unattainable. Like, you don't think it's a genuine, like, a job that anyone can do. Like, it's almost like looking at Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie or a movie star or something, where you just go, oh, I could never do that. Like, that is just something, there's a confidence and there's writing all that material, and then how do you get the break and how do you actually get on stage and do it? And, you know, you just think, oh, that's not a real job. Like, I couldn't tell a careers officer that's what I wanted to do. And then I just got a job where I was 16 and my mum was like, right, off you go. And go and get yourself a job, pay some rent and that. And they really turn, don't they, at 16? And then I just went around to my dad's local, basically. I'd rung up a few places, like I'd rung up a load of places, and everyone said, no, we don't need anyone. And then I think they did a little 1471 and just went, look, can you come in? We've got a wedding and the guy who washes the dishes is not turned up.
Sure.
So put a tie on and come on down. So I went, it was like a Saturday afternoon. I went and I turned up. There was a huge pile of washing, like the biggest pile of washing, like taller than me. They've had this huge wedding. I was like, right, 16. Like, all right, let's, here we go. Like, I'm getting 12 quid, like, for this. Mm-hmm. And I was like, where's your dishwasher? She was like, he's wearing a tie. And I went in and started washing up, and then they gave me the job. And so it was just a pub that had a function room upstairs. And as it happened, they had a comedy night on a Thursday night, which I didn't know at the time, but it was quite a big comedy night. You know, it was a real, it'd been running for sort of 15, 20 years and everyone had played there. And I'd always loved stand-up comedy. I'd always been interested, but it was just luck, really. And I'd ended up working in this comedy club. I wasn't actually old enough to serve drinks or anything, so I was only 16, but I went out and collected glasses and used to watch all the stand-up. Always get told off for watching the stand-up instead of working. And then just one of those sort of things where, and I saw some brilliant comics and I saw some terrible comics as well, which was, if anything, is more helpful because that makes it more realistic. You think, well, I can definitely be terrible.
And then
one night, and I was always making the landlady laugh. Like, she was this old Irish woman and her daughter, you know, she was sort of in her 30s and I was this 16-year-old sort of smart ass, and I was always making her laugh with daft stories. Obviously at the time, you know, you'd get comics, well, like now, you know, you get comics from all over, and there was a couple of comics coming up, as always, sharing a car, you know, two or three of them in the car, and it broke down, and this is about 6:30, 7:00, the show starts at, you know, 7:30, and they rang the promoter, Agraman, the human anagram. That's his best joke. And John Marshall, who's sort of a bit of a legend, like, within stand-up, and he was panicking, you know, he's ringing around trying to get the comics, you know, they're in the local area, Mick Ferry and Alex Boardman and people like that who were sort of big Mancunian comics who usually would be busy. And he got a couple in and he was just desperate. He was absolutely desperate. And the landlady said, Jason's funny. Why don't you put him on? I'm like, what? In the middle of washing a glass, like, I said, what? And he said, well, no, I need some comedians, like. And he said, oh, he's got loads of funny stories. He'll do 10 minutes. I was like, well, you remember how long 10 minutes was before you started, you know? And I said, oh, all right. I don't know where it came from. I suppose just being 16, I think. I don't know. And so I said, all right, I'll do 10 minutes. And I think he liked the idea, I think, in the sort of, like the water boy, like, sort of thing. He's just sort of go, oh, well, have a go, like, see how it goes. And he let us have a go. And I mean, I'd like to say it was like Hollywood and it was amazing, but it wasn't quite.
Okay. But that's sort of why I ask, because it does have that kind of Hollywood feel to it. Yeah. I know you've told the story a lot of times, you often get asked it, but it comes up in almost every interview that I've read with you while researching this. And I just wonder whether that helped, whether it helped you to have such a kind of, you know, it's sort of, now it's kind of arguably your rags to riches story. But yeah, the fact it sort of seemed almost like someone could have written it. Like it's a prepackaged. It's quite, do you know what it is? It's quite ITV.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And you're
well,
quite,
I've certainly not stopped that.
Well, there, exactly. But and you're quite ITV.
Yeah, yeah, quite.
And I just wonder if you think that the direction that you've taken in your career is anything to do with you had such a kind of, I don't know. I don't know quite what I'm asking. It's whether the fact that you had such a sort of, you know, lad done good kind of story.
Yeah,
whether
I know
that
what you
kind
mean.
Of set the path that you went there.
It was an odd one, really, because I started, and I'll be honest with you, I was 6 months in and I thought I was amazing. Like I properly thought, I've cracked this. I mean, I was eight gigs after that gig, I won the Northwest Comedian of the Year with 7 minutes of material. Mm-hmm. And the year before me, Peter Kay had won it. Mm-hmm. Carolina Hearn had won it the year before him. Dave Spikey was a finalist. Johnny Vegas was a finalist. People who you know who've never won it. And I won it. Like I'm properly like pissed it, like properly won it. With 7 minutes of material, and I was 16, and people were giving me like £50 to do these gigs, and I was going, I am brilliant. Yeah. I'm properly brilliant. And then the second I realised, the second I thought I was brilliant, I stopped being any good at it. Mm. And I had like 2 years of going, I'm really rubbish at this.
Okay.
And it was a really odd come down to earth.
Do you think that? I mean, you were presumably sort of visibly 16. You didn't look older than your years. You looked like a 16-year-old.
Do you know what? I certainly was maturer than my years. And as always, I do seem, you know, I seem to have older references than a normal, you know, a regular 16-year-old.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe because of my family and stuff. And my dad is a funny bloke. And so just by sort of osmosis, you know, you seem older. Your stories seem older. And also my jokes weren't about being a 16-year-old. They were looking back, but they were, you know, they're saying what was school like or what it's like having crappy part-time
they were very
jobs
accessible
or the
jokes.
Local area. Yeah, so they weren't, you know, I see a lot of comics who are very young. I mean, Daniel Sloss has come out of it now. He's come out the other side now and he's doing proper material. You know what I mean? Material that doesn't matter that he's a young lad. And that was an experience. But I suppose what happened for me was I spent ages writing all these jokes for this. Well, I say ages. I mean, ages at the time was like half a day.
Yeah.
And you know, for this gig that I'd managed to wangle. And a few weeks earlier, I'd been mugged in Moss Side in Manchester, and so I had a big right black eye, like a big thick lip, and so I had a couple of tooth knocked out and stuff, and so I wandered on, and so I looked like this as well doing my first gig, and I don't know what I was talking about when I first wrote some stuff. I remember I had some material about we had this big wheel in Manchester, and I used to go past it all the time on the way to college, and I always used to see these little scroats, these scallies and that spinning. Even though there was all these signs saying no, don't spin it, they were like spinning them, and I used to walk past thinking it'd be brilliant if they were actually unscrewing it, wouldn't they? If they were as they were up there unscrewing, yeah. And that was the first sort of observation. I sort of thought, oh, that's quite a funny thing. Like, and I used to sort, and I got to a point where I just used to hang around near the big wheel, and then people would look up to them spinning, and I go, it'd be good if they were unscrewing that, wouldn't it? Like, I just hang around, just do that one observation. And that was my first taste of it, really. And then, so I was doing this stuff on stage. So I got on stage and started doing this stuff. Then I had, you know, because at that point, you don't know about the rules of stand-up either. You don't know that you can't just do jokes or that you can't, you know, that you can't just go, oh, I heard a funny thing. Oh, I got a funny email with some funny stuff on it. I'll just read out some of those funny things. Like, I'll do the answers from, you know, Family Fortune, like daft answers from Family Fortune. I think I genuinely did that. I think I did that for about a year.
Sure.
Like, here's some funny answers from Family Fortunes. Used to get a big laugh. And it was only the comics at the back going, you can't do that, like, you know, shaking their head. So, but you just don't know the rules when you start. And I was about 4 minutes into this 7 minute routine, and it was going okay. You know, they were nice. I mean, don't forget, I'd also been working there for the last sort of few months.
Sure.
You know, so they sort of knew us. And
so it's like the end of a film. You've just been beaten up.
Yeah, it was a nice. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then someone heckled me and went, "What's happened to your face?" And it threw me. I wasn't expecting to get heckled on my first ever gig. And I said, I got mugged. And they properly laughed. And I said, what are you laughing at? And I said, I got mugged in my side the other week, properly laughing. Like, and I was going, no, really, I did. They were howled in their sides, like the pain I'd been through. And I'd had this thing at the time where, you know, when you, again, like you always try and make things, you make light of a bad situation, you know. And I remember, it was not a nice experience, obviously, but I remember the guy saying to me clearly, and like a comedian, no matter, even if you're just about to face death, if there's a joke there,
yeah,
you go, well, I may as well take it. Like, you know what I mean? Or sure. Remember that for later on. And I remember the guy clearly saying, give us your money or we'll beat you up. And I remember giving him my money with those options. I remember giving him my money and then he beat me up anyway. And I remember afterwards, not necessarily being upset that I'd lost £6, but upset that, like, he'd broken our verbal contract. Like, yeah, he'd entered into an agreement, you know. And I spoke about that, and it was weird that sort of, you know, I mean, they always say, don't they, tragedy and comedy are, mm-hmm. you know, are bedfellows. So, yeah, it was interesting sort of getting laughs off that. And so my first gig, I learned that big lesson, you know.
Sure. So when you said you'd spent an afternoon writing for
yes,
that.
Yes, yeah.
So I want to talk about the gig, for a minute about the writing process. You were kind of just assembling stuff that you'd previously observed, or were you...
Yeah, there was no discipline to it. No, I was just literally thinking, how am I going to fill 7 minutes? And I had a couple of funny stories about the family, you know, a couple of funny stories about the pub that we worked in. And that was it, really. You know, there was nothing major. Like, it wasn't, like, I think about the work I put in now.
Sure.
You know, I didn't put that work in.
Well, I remember seeing you backstage. I did the warm-up for the Comedy Annual maybe 2 years ago. Mm. And I remember seeing you backstage with a laptop open.
Yes.
Working on individual two-line, what about this one? And there was someone from your management there. And you're like, what about this one? You prefer that one? Mm. And you were really, really focused on it in a way that was one of the first times I saw someone certainly about to go and do stand-up on TV doing the last-minute kind of prep.
Yeah, completely,
So there's obviously... I want to sort of talk about two things with that. One is the actual writing process and how that's changed. But also, what I'm fascinated with is that you are probably one of the most accessible comics that I've ever seen. Right. Like, your stuff, your Mr. Accessibility, like, there's nobody, like, there's young people in here. We haven't had, we haven't had younger people come in and watch any of the guests on this. But you sort of appeal to everyone. And I just wonder if that's a deliberate choice that you've made, or if it just comes out of who you are as a person. Because your stuff, and I don't mean this as a criticism, but you're not trying to challenge people with your comedy.
Not at all. I've always said that. I just think people don't always want to go out for a good think. You know what I mean? I think, do you know what I mean? It's Friday night, you've had a long week. Just have a laugh for a couple of hours, you know what I mean? So but weirdly, I do like watching those comedians, you know, when I'm not... but I think, you know, over the years, it seems to be, if you're in the middle of the road, like, people seem to be... That seems to be derisory, like, oh, no, he's in, you know, he's... And I think, well, we can't all be on the edge, we'll fall off, you know what I mean? So, if you speak to people like Frankie Boyle and Stuart Lee and people who are, you know, towards the edge of comedy... The bright ones will acknowledge me, I suppose, and McIntyre and Bishop and the people who are keeping the middle, because you need the middle, you know. But otherwise, you can't be alternative to it. You know what I mean?
So did you ever consider yourself an alternative comedian?
No. I mean, I sort of feel like I. You know, a lot of people feel they came out of that 80s boom of, you know, the Comedy Store, you know, the Young Ones and Alexis Sale and people. I feel very much like I sort of just followed the Northern comics, you know, the club comics, really. They're just having a laugh. And I suppose Billy Connolly and, you know, Jasper Carrot and Dave Allen, people who are sort of pioneers of what we're doing today, really. Mm-hmm. You know, so I feel a little bit more... akin to them than I do to that lot. So
okay. And do you ever feel yourself kind of going, oh, maybe I could have done a different track, or I could have kind of searched more with the stuff, or do you feel like you're really comfortable where you are with doing this?
No, I'm not comfortable. I've never been comfortable with my set, with my comic, with my comedy. I like it.
Why is that? Why are you not comfortable with it?
Because I just always think I can be better, you know what I mean? I always think there's something better. Like, I went to see Louis C.K. and all my mates were like crying laughing, and I just sat there like this. And they were like, you having a good time? I was like, yeah, I am, yeah. And afterwards they were like, you didn't really laugh. I was like, I just was watching him going, what am I doing? Like, what am I doing compared to that? Like, there was just something, I felt like I'm going, hey, look at all these funny things that happen, all these daft things. Don't people say these funny things, and kids are like this, and jobs are like this, and all, you know. And he's saying those same things. He's talking about kids, he's talking about jobs, he's talking about society. But I feel like he's going, here's all these funny things that have happened, and here's why they happen.
Yeah, okay.
And I feel like there's just another level. And sure. I don't know where it is. I don't know if sure. it's age or if it's experience or it's just your personal. I don't know what it. I don't know where that next level is. I don't know. I can't find it. You know, and I'm trying. You know, and I'm always trying to be better.
But are you trying to be better in the sense of you want more tags on your existing punchlines? You want big rolling laughs?
No, no.
Or are you're challenging yourself to discover more about yourself as a comic?
Yeah, and I think there's a. I mean, I don't want to sound arsey like in a sort of, oh, I want to be like a social...
No. This is the forum.
No,
to
of
say
course, but
mean,
I mean, like, there's a point where where comics become like a social commentator, you know, and they talk about. And I find, I don't know if it's a British thing as well, maybe, or maybe it's just like you said, I'm ITV or I've done BBC One and I've been and it's been hammered. It does get hammered into you, like, look, these are your boundaries. Just play within them, on telly. You know, they're the rules. And I feel a little bit like there is something else, you know, and there is a way of. I'm not on, like, don't get me wrong, I go on stage and I tell funny stories, I'm more than happy with that, but I know I just think your horizons become your middle distance, you know, and every so often you just go, right, I want, that's where I want to be, you know what I mean, that's who I want to be, that's how I want to be. I think the day you go, I've made it,
sure,
I'm brilliant,
sure,
and I discovered that, you know, by thinking I was sure. great when I was 17, so
yeah, right. Do you ever find that? I mean, there must be when you're doing a 150 date tour to 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 seater venues. There must be a weight of responsibility on you to keep. I mean, is there a weight of responsibility on, to keep giving them what they want?
I think there's an element of like I was going to say, sorry, about being after doing BBC and ITV and those sort of things. Is that in America, and a lot of the American acts that I've listened to, there seems to be less. And Louis C.K., I mean, some of the stuff he talks about, if he was here, he'd be on the front page of the Daily Mail every couple of days, you know what I mean? Sure. Just for something that he'd said as a joke, you know, as a joke, people get offended by it. So I think, I definitely have that sometimes in the back of my mind of thinking, right, well, my audience, at some point, they've become accustomed to a way of the stuff I'm going to be talking about. But also I panic as well, like Louis C.K. will talk for 2 minutes with no joke, no punchline. Mm-hmm. I'm about 20 seconds in before, like, it's squeaky bum time. I think, oh, why has no one laughed? So that's part of my own, you know, that I need to work that out as well, I think.
Sure. Will you get the chance to? I mean, like, you can't really go for 2 minutes on stage without getting a laugh, or can you? Could you push yourself to do that?
Some,
I mean,
some
in
corporates
a successful...
have had, I've gone half an hour.
Sure. I mean, what I mean is, do the demands of the big tours that you do mean that your preparation has to be, I've got to make all of this razor sharp? Or is there any part of your previews, your preparation process, where you can take the sort of risks that a big bit doesn't get a laugh, but you're pursuing, you're searching for something in it?
So I feel like, so me and Louis C.K. have got a bit about smacking kids.
Yeah.
And he is very much anti-smacking kids. He's like, it's the worst thing you can possibly do as an adult human being. What, you're such a bully? Like, and he's got, that's his opinion. Like, not only is it his opinion, he's forthright in it and he goes for it. And as an audience member, if you're sat in the audience thinking, I do sometimes smack my kids, like, you'd be thinking, what's going on here? Whereas I feel this, a pressure of trying to please everyone, even people who smack their kids. So even in my bit, I
got to get that important kid smacking market.
I feel like I do my bit about, and I say some people get it wrong, and I've got this bit about a woman in the supermarket who did it and it was really weird, and I say how wrong, and then I just find myself going, you know, but God, hey, nothing to do with me what you do. Like, and I feel like I have to sort of go.
Sure. I noticed that last night. There are little kind of almost, not quite get outs. I don't know what the word is.
No, it's a way of going, oh, I hope no one feels bad about that. I just said that. That's a weird.
And you are rewarded for that as well, because, like I said, you're Mr. Accessibility.
Mm.
Your audience size grows. You know, you sell all the tickets.
Yeah.
So you are sort of being rewarded by the public for doing stuff that isn't necessarily that challenging, or for being their friend.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't, at the moment, I don't feel like it's my job to do that. Like, I don't feel like. And I don't feel like I've got the skill set to do that.
Do you feel it's your job to please us as the audience?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I've never got to, at the moment, I mean, I would like to be and get to a place where I think, oh, that's quite a, you know, so people do go away and go, oh, that was interesting, that was thoughtful, that was what it was. But at the moment, I just think, so it's just jokes and that. It's just messing around, just daft, and I've got, enough of them to have a go with it. I do feel a pressure of. I feel a pressure. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's a working class guilt or a. I don't know what it is, but I do feel a pressure of when you go to a town, and you know you've charged your £25, And you think, right, and all the time thinking, right, that's two, what if two people have come and that's 50 quid, then whatever those booking fee pirates charge, you know, there's another 25 quid, I don't know what they charge, fiver each or whatever. Then they've got a taxi, babysitter, maybe they went for a meal, like that. You know, I'm thinking all of a sudden it's 100 odd quid for a couple to come out and see you. So, and then there's 2,000 of them who've all done that. And I do that to myself in the dressing room before I come out. I think, what am I doing? I've just added this massive pressure to myself. But it does make me go, like, it genuinely makes me appreciate it. Like, when I go out, I never, ever take it for granted that everyone's there. Like, I always think, like, you know, when money's tight, you know, and again, don't get me wrong, I'm doing all right. Like, I don't have to worry about that as much anymore. But I've still got family and, you know, I've still got a very working class family around me. And so I still see it and I'm still aware of it. And it's odd, you know, it's odd. It is odd to put that sort of, that weird, to a point where this year I think I dropped my tickets from 25 quid to £22.50 on the tour, because these booking people winds me up, right? But they charge like a fiver booking, even though you're booking it yourself. That winds me up. And they charge a fiver on top. And I thought, do you know what? All of a sudden people are saying to me, it's cost me, and there's like a £1 restoration fee on some of these places. You think, whatever, you're making this up. So suddenly someone spent 32 quid, whatever, on a 31, 32 quid.
Could you ever tackle that subject that you feel passionately about on stage?
I have mentioned, you know, it's been a thing, and I've spoke to other comics about it. Sarah Millican, she didn't do a load of venues that did that. I didn't find out about that until I'd already booked my touring, because again, and that's something I'll do on the next one. You know, so there is ways of doing it, but I thought, well, I'll drop mine by £2.50, and then it's like we've gone halves each on the booking fee. You know what I mean? Like, okay. I thought that seemed like a fair,
that's classic Manford,
fair swap. Yeah. And my agent was like, you know, that'll cost you this much money. I was like, oh well, it's not yours if you never had it, is it?
So this is Jason. You can hear how deeply he cares about giving all of his audience members value for money. And that desire to please people is something I think a lot of us are very familiar with. It's also fascinating to hear how that pressure has maybe informed some of his creative decisions. Lots more on that coming up. It's bloody classic ComCom pod here, if you ask me. I've got some listener emails that I'm quickly going to go over. Justin emailed me. He used to run a comedy club. I won't say where. I haven't told him I was going to read this one out. I sort of think it's implicit that if you send me something, I might read it out. But equally, I might just reduce the names to protect the innocent. He used to run a comedy club, he says, which lost money every night. But I'm keen, despite the losses, to get it going again. So the bits of information about how stand-up and clubs have changed over the years, especially as many comics say in your shows over the past 5 years, is invaluable. He goes on to say, it was a bit frustrating for me, though, that there was a knowing yes from your interviewees about the change in audiences and clubs in general over the past 5 years. No one was really specific about those changes, so that's some information I would like to know. Well, Justin, I've posted your email over at the Facebook group, so if any of my listeners fancy sticking their oar in over there, if you've got any perspectives on what's been going on over the last 5 years, I won't sort of bore you to death with it here. I suppose that sounds like I'm being deliberately obtuse. I'm not. I just think there's a lot of different people's perspectives on what's been happening to comedy as a result of, I guess, a couple of things: the recession, the boom in comedy on TV, which means, of course, so many more people have started becoming comedians and starting doing comedy. At the same time, clubs have been actively reducing reducing the number of nights that are on. So there's lots of different things going on there, but go over to the Facebook group if you like, and you can talk to, I mean, I don't know if Justin's on Facebook even or part of the group, but if you put your answers there, we'll go over them in a future show. And another email here from Colin. Colin says, I've been meaning to drop you a line to say how much I'm enjoying them, having arrived late and quickly set about shoveling the back catalogue down with both fists. What a lovely image, Colin. He says, I'm now at that stage where I leave them on repeat at night, like dodgy hypnotherapy tapes from the back of the Sunday People. So do drop me a line. Thank you, Colin. Drop me a line, anyone, at info@comedianscomedian.com, and let me know how you use the podcast. I'd be very interested to hear. I'm very pleased I'm helping people sleep at night, and I wonder if you'll all wake up weird. Email me, tweet me at ComComPod. Thank you for your feedback. Read the ComCom TV test episode, and the title, in fact. We're going to get a bunch together and start releasing extracts from the show on YouTube. That should come together hopefully for January or the beginning of the year. So look forward to that. And thank you, of course, so much for your donations to the running costs of the show. I think more specifically for helping me recover from Edinburgh, which is going very nicely. Thank you. Some of you have also been leaving little notes with your donations on PayPal, little messages. It does give you that option. And I'm very pleased to receive them, whatever the amount. People have been chucking everything from 5 to 50 quid at me. And in one case, rather more than that, to the extent that I had to email back and make sure it wasn't a typing error. I'll keep you posted on how that develops. Just go to the comedianscomedian.com website and you can find, I should say, the comedianscomedian.com website, and you can find the donate button there. Keep listening too after the show for a new way that you can help the podcast whilst helping yourself out at the same time. And finally, before we go back to Jason, I thought of a little Twitter game. I was in a service station the other day on the way to a gig. No, really. Yes, occasionally that happens. And I realised I always tend to buy the same thing, probably out of a desire to be, I don't know, not too unhealthy, but also, you know, after a while you go, yep, I know what I like this. And I particularly noticed it because I've been doing my tax recently and the same receipts keep cropping up. It's very depressing. So being a deeply boring man, I took a picture of the food that was in my hand and I tweeted it. You can too. Just take a photo of your pathetically habitual service station road food and tweet me with the hashtag #hacksnacks. And let's have that with a CKS at the end, not an X, we're not Americans. Unless you are American, in which case, knock yourself out. So hashtag #hacksnacks and a photograph of the food that you hate to admit you buy every single time on your way to a gig. More on that later. Now it's back to Jason Manford.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So let's talk about the writing. Let's talk about of the stuff. So when you came to make this show, say, are you the sort of person that sort of has a week's plan of okay, I'm going to do a certain number of hours here, or you're working in an office? In what circumstances do you write?
Well, I'll tell you, to go back a little bit to when I was doing the circuit, and obviously when you're doing the circuit, once you get 20 minutes, that's you. You're done. You get your £150 Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, and you know, you're happy, like, you know, you, and then gradually you get to a point where you're doing 6 or 7 gigs a week and, you know, earning that same amount of money, and you and it's great and it's easy, and all you needed to do was write 20 minutes of stuff. But that's, you know, and a lot of comics that's enough, you know, that's enough to get to. And I was always a bit like, you know, that'll do us, like, I'm happy with this life, this is fine. And then I saw Peter Kay. I saw Peter Kay before I even started stand up. He did the gig that I used to work at quite regular. And he, I mean, whatever you think of him these days in 2013, even he is one of the best loved comedians in the country. He's funny bones. He's naturally just a brilliant entertainer, and he was fascinating to watch. And early on, he was brilliant. I mean, he's great now, but it was just a revelation, and we had a lot in common, and we sort of chatted, and we sort of become friends a little bit, and I was asking him about his like writing thing, and because he said to me, "What do you want to do with your career?" And I said, "I'd just like to play these couple of gigs, and you know, get me 300 quid a weekend, and I'll be happy." Like, and he said, "How much do you write a week?" And I said, "What do you mean? I've got me 20 minutes. Like, don't need to do any more." Like, I said, "Occasionally I'll have a flip through the paper, see if anything funny's happened." And he said, "You know, the rest of the country does 35 hours a week, don't you?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I realise that's roughly what a full-time job is, 35 hours plus." He said, "Well, that's how much time you should be putting into this job." Mm-hmm. And I thought, God, that does sort of make sense. Like, you know, if it is your full-time job, then you should definitely do that. it's hard early on when you've got a part-time job and you've got other things going on. And so I started then trying to treat it a little bit more like a job, not necessarily sitting in an office and writing, but certainly just making sure I was reading everything, I was across everything, and jotting everything down that I could. And so now my process is I start thinking about the tour, and I've always got bits and bobs. You know, you've got the little note thing on your phone, you're jotting these little ideas down. Sometimes in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, you wake up chuckling to yourself, you're like, write that down, wake up the next morning, you're like, oh, it doesn't actually make any sense now. And, you know, and I sort of get to that point where I think, right, here are a couple of ideas that I think are good and fun to do. And there's also a little bit of pressure on my family and friends and stuff like that now, where I'm like, look, you need to start being funnier, because they're getting a little bit self-aware now, I think, and keeping stuff from me.
Yeah, I mean, really?
Yeah, my mum the other day, she went, oh, Margaret said to me the other day, and I went, and then she stopped. She went, why have you stopped? She went, no, doesn't matter. I was like, no, she knows as soon as she said it, it's going in the act. Like,
sure.
So, you know, I'm always observant in that respect. But I get, you know, I get every single paper delivered every single morning. I get the magazines, even ones I don't necessarily want to read, like Take a Break or Bella or whatever. Like, I read everything right through.
How long does that take?
It's a process. Like, you know, but I'm speed reader now, so I'm flicking through. And don't forget, most newspapers are covering the same stories. Like,
sure,
so there's nothing,
sure. But you've trained in speed reading. So
yeah,
you
I'm
could
pretty
do that.
Much like. I mean, I don't train as such, okay, as I can, sure, sort of have a flick through and go for it and have a little look at those little ones that's.
And what do you do? Are you kind of drawing rings around things that might be?
Yeah,
important,
and I cut things out and I keep things to one side. And I'm not as prolific as I was. Like, there was a point where, I mean, even now when I think about how much material I've written, I mean, this is my third tour. You know, I've done four or five Apollos or road shows. I've done, you know, I've had a couple of series of my own show. You know, there's probably about, I've probably written about 10 hours of material. And so, which, when you think at one point I was happy with 20 minutes, you know, it's quite a situation to get to. But yeah, for this tour, I panicked, to be honest. It was a real panic this tour at the beginning. This was this time last year, because obviously the tickets go on sale a year before you have, sure, to actually start doing any gigs. So you're like, fine, I've got a year.
Okay.
And then your agent starts ringing you up going, hey, we've sold 4,000 tickets this week. And you're like, oh God, like they've just bought something that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of pressure there. And then, January. And then so what I do is I book loads of club gigs. So I ring up loads of clubs. And I just say, can you put us on? And I just do little, like really little 40-seater rooms and stuff. And I just go in as, like, unannounced, like special guest or whatever they want to write down. And all over the country to try and get a... So otherwise I become a bit northern-centric if I don't spread the love light. So I sort of try and get out, do all these club gigs as much as I can, which is terrifying. A lot of that's getting your sea legs back and just getting, sure, back on stage after 18
And what
months.
Are you doing, just to complete the process, what are you doing when you've cut out the stuff, you've got the kind of news stories?
So what I do at the beginning is I do my old set. Like, I get on and I do 20 minutes, 25 minutes of just... like the gold, like the stuff that you know is bang, 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 sure, gag, gag, gag. And that's just confidence. That's just like, let's just get this back. Let's get the, you know, get steady on your feet and get a few heckles and deal with them and just, you know, do a few Saturday nights in the middle of, you know, wherever and sort that. And that's my first process, is just to get confident again on stage. Because it does leave you, like, if you have a bit of time off. And then what I do then is I slip some new stories in. But I always put them in between two winners. So I'll have two gags that I think, right, them two are good gags, and I'll just put this little shoot, you know, like a plant, you know, a little shoot in there, and just gradually, you know, it's got these two crutches either side, and gradually that sprouts, and I go, right, I don't need you two anymore, I've got this one.
Okay, and is that something that you've written? Is that something that you've gone away and written on a laptop?
You'll I do write now, there? Yeah. I actually write a lot of stuff out, like, word for word, and when I start,
that
doing,
surprises me, because you're so conversational. That's, it comes up in all your reviews.
But
what I do
is I'm conversational first, and then I write it down off what I've said, rather than, you know, write it down first and then read what it says.
Sure.
And then I go and do a load, and then I do some gigs where I only do new stuff, and I just take like a pad of paper like that, and I've got bullet points of the jokes and ideas that I've got, and I just read jokes off paper, which is weird because if someone knows who you are and they've seen you on telly, then it's like some people think, oh, that's quite a little treat, like someone's come to our little place in Lytham St Anne's or, you know, Berwick-upon-Tweed or somewhere where nobody really goes, like. But if nobody knows who you are, if it's just an old bloke going, this is the most unprofessional comedian I've ever seen.
Sure.
Like, you just look like a dick. But, you know, and I just read, you know, I just genuinely just read and I tick, you know, tick a joke. If it gets a laugh, I tick it off. And I got a laugh.
Do you have rules and principles for how to find the funny in something? What decisions is it that you're making when you see something in the newspaper and you go, oh, this might work? Like, presumably, do you also, because there's a lot of people reading, there's a lot of topical comics.
Yes, quite.
Do you also have to kind of go, you know, does stuff get burned because you see someone else has already done it?
I try and relate anything in the paper back to a personal story.
Okay.
Just to me. So that way, and that's another thing I remember Peter saying, that, which was, you know, nobody can steal your life, you know what I mean? So people can steal a gag, people can steal an observation that you've made in, you know, a newspaper, but nobody can steal your joke that's yours, you know what I mean? And or an experience that you've had. So what I do is I try and relate stuff back, really. So, you know, I like, so for example, David Cameron left his, you know, he left his daughter in a pub a couple of, you know, a year ago, whatever it was in the paper. So then I go, right, well, that's a story. That, and then off the launch of that, I can then talk about when I used to go to the pub as a kid and my parents used to take me and, you know, and talk about all those, you know, like trying to get a game of pool with adults or whatever it was, you know.
Presumably though, if you're planning a tour that doesn't exist yet, or the tour exists but the show doesn't exist, by the time you get round to the end of the tour, that David Cameron story is a year or more on.
Yeah, I mean, I've got stuff that I've just got rid of, which is about the London riots, you know, that I thought that I love and I gets a big laugh, but what can you do? You can't, unless, you know, you can't just sit in your house praying for another riot.
Have you heard these riots they've been having in Indonesia? Reminds me,
I think that comics put a bit too much pressure on themselves about being topical, because you're harder on yourself than an audience is. An audience just are like, is it funny? Well, that's all I'm bothered about. Like, no audience is going to be giving it, well, I think that's 4 months out of date. You know what I mean? Like, nobody's that bothered, you know.
What's your response, though, if you get reviewed? Like, you know, audiences might not mind, but do you bother with reviews? Do you engage with that sort of process?
They don't even pay for a ticket, those assholes. So I think I'm only gigging to the people who've paid to see it.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, don't get me wrong, I read them, and I'm not happy about them if they're not nice. But I, you know, they just...
They can't really contradict 2,000 people.
Well, the other thing is with a critic is that they've seen loads and loads of comedy. Like, they've seen lots of stand-up, hundreds and hundreds of shows. Whereas an audience have seen three, like, that year. If and that's if they're, you know, prolific at it. So you can't really go off of a reviewer. Like, I'm not even aware what, like, you know, the term hack. You know, when a subject becomes a hack subject. You know, on the circuit, you're aware of what's... Oh, don't talk about airplane food, because you know, and stuff, because everyone does it. You know, don't talk about such a thing. Loads of comics have got jokes about that. When you're on the circuit, that's self-policing, because there's three or four of you on the bill and you'll hear someone go, oh, right, is that a subject that they're doing? On my last tour, how am I to know that? Like, I'm tour by myself, like, so I don't know that, you know, the... unexpected item in the baggage area is a subject that, you know, has been covered by hundreds of comics. I'm just going, well, this is a bit funny, I'll do. And it's only when you read a review and they go, oh, and he did this, that was like loads of other comics, you're like, well, I didn't know that. So
do you feel that there's a responsibility to know what's current, what's being done? Like, if you're writing for a panel show, say, or you're performing, or you're doing something on TV where you might be the fourth act on a mixed bill on a Christmas show or something, Is might that be an issue, that you then see someone before you and go, oh, Christ, they're doing unexpected item in the banking area?
Yeah, I mean, it's different with telly, of course, because they, as you know, they will, a producer will ring you and say, what are all your subjects? You know what I mean? So that's ruled out before you've even got to the studio floor, really. But
I get what you're saying about, like, you don't encounter that stuff.
I don't know. Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, you know, you can be aware of stuff, and you can, and also what I've got is I've got three or four mates. You know, I've got Gary Delaney, I've got... Brendan Riley, another couple of comics who I will who I'll just ring up, Andrew Bird, I'll just ring up and I'll say, "What? This is a, is this a funny idea? This is a funny," and they'll talk, and they will be the, like someone like Gary Delaney's, sure. You know, I don't know if you've seen his show, but he's encyclopedic about when it comes to stand-up.
Has anyone done this? Well, Emo Phillips did it in 1975.
Yeah. So he'll know stuff like, you know, so that I use that quite a bit as a, you know, what do you think about this? You know, and that's helpful. And I always use, and I use those guys as well to help me with the show, you know, so I get to a point where I think, right, I've got an hour, and I think that's and I think it's funny, and then I'll be still doing the warm up. So after I've done the club gigs, I'll then book in a load of warm ups, like 25 warm up gigs in really little towns, you know, and Barrow in Furness or you know wherever these little places, and then I'll go along and say, this is a tryout, you know, it's a whatever, it's a 5 or a 10 or whatever it is, and then I'll just try out stuff. And then I'll invite a couple of mates. So I'll invite, I've got a mate called Steve Edge, who's, who used to be a comic years and years ago. He's an actor now. And he's really, like, he's the funniest bloke I know. So he comes along and afterwards we just have a massive chat about the set. And he's like, oh, that bit you do is really funny. Why don't you say this at the end? And I go, yeah, I will.
Yeah, and, okay. You know, so it's sort of an unofficial, like not a director, but an outside eye.
Yeah, that's it. Okay. And you just need that. Like I was doing a joke for about, sometimes you don't know. Like, you just think a joke's a joke. You think, oh, that's a funny observation, and that's a joke. And only when someone says, why don't you say this at the end, and adds a punchline, you think, oh, yeah, now it's a joke. That's just been like a jokeoid for the last...
Sure, okay.
So I had one on the last tour where I said, when you go to get your kids on the when they send you home from the hospital, and you strap your kids in the car, and you're panicking, and you're really worried about the journey home, and you know the responsibility, the pressure of driving home. You drive about 4 miles an hour all the way home because you're so nervous, and you're crying, and there's like tractors overtaking you, old people walking past you on the pavement, and it was just an observation that, and then I used that, and then started to talk about other things, right? But I was sort of saying that in the shape of a joke, like that was it. That bit that I just did. And Gary Delaney said to me, why don't you say, you know, you're driving home, you're going 4 miles an hour, there's tractors overtaking, there's people walking past you on the pavement. Every time you go around a corner, you can hear the baby moving about in the boot. Like, and I go, okay, right, now it's a joke.
Sure, now it's a joke. Know, now it's a joke. The steps leading up to it that's are also it. Funny steps.
Yeah, so that's it. And that is really important, I think, is to have people that you trust and mates around you that you can banter with and get some stuff out of, because it's a lonely process. And
And it's got to be lonelier. I mean, stand-up comedy itself, at someone at my level, is quite an isolating profession.
Yeah.
And I'm still going to clubs and seeing people, even if I don't necessarily stay that often. But when you're touring on your own,
But what a weird process to be thinking, right? I've got you know, 200,000 people have bought tickets to see my show. Yet I'm going to just sit in a room by myself and write it and not actually say it out loud to anyone else before I see them. You know, that seems odd to me. So that's, I think it's good to have those people that you trust around you to chip in, you know.
When you were doing the show last night, there was a section of it where you were reading out suggestions that people, because the show's called First World Problems.
Yes.
Which I think actually you said something, I couldn't believe you said it actually. You said, that seemed like a nice generic title.
Yes.
Is that a window on your process that you kind of like...
They come to you and say, right, you need to write a show, and you go, all right, and I'll start writing one. And then they say, and a lot of comics mention it, certainly at Edinburgh as well, because you've got to come up with it a year before you've even started writing it. So it'd be like coming up with the, you know, you think, right, I'm going to write a book.
Yeah.
Right, here's the title. And then you've got to try and write a book under that, the banner of that title. So so I just thought, I'm not putting my pressure on me this time. You know, last time I called it something like Turning Into My Dad or something, but really every stand-up show just should be called just Moaning with Punchlines, right? That's basically that's what every show is, right? And
well, that's next year's title.
That's so there you go. Jot that down. And I thought, do you know what, that seems like a generic title. First World Problems, I mean, everything can be under that banner, like everything I'm talking about, and I don't even need to talk about it. I just, it's got that, everyone knows the phrase now, it's done the rounds online. And also the other important thing is that it separates your tour. And this is something I learned on the last tour. I didn't think about it. I just called it, or the tour before, I just called it Jason Manford Live or whatever. I didn't even think about it. But when you do a tour the length of my tour started in, well, I started the process in, you know, the clubs in January, but I started, the official tour date started at the end of May and I finished at the end of next April. So it's a long tour, so much so that people forget. And if you go back to a town because you sold out the last two times you were there, and you go back to, people will come back again.
Yes, sure.
Because it's been eight
not
months.
Not realising it's the same show.
Yeah, okay. So the title, you need a title that sticks in their mind
at least. Did you think, though, I mean, I've got to be honest, when I first saw the title was First World Problems, I sort of thought that already existed as a joke on Twitter.
As a thing, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of a thing.
Mm.
And that's quite unusual, I think, that it's almost like it was sort of, you know, a shorthand sort of concept. It was a funny concept in itself.
Yeah, I just...
Did you feel you'd sort of co-opted that, or it was just a
no, not really. I just felt like it was a phrase that was out there already that nobody owned, but it summed up lots of things without, you know, without actually having to specify.
It fits the moaning with problems concept,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Quite. Yeah, quite. So it's... but yeah, and then I set the... it's different in Edinburgh because you don't have an interval, but on tour I tried to do it quite a bit. I set a challenge before the interval, or you know, it's something to just to fill the time a little bit as well, and also to make it different for me. You know, I do a lot of, okay. I do a lot of gigs every
and
night.
And this is the bit where you're asking people to write down their first world
problems. So I say, "What are yours?" Yeah, what are yours? And
when you say it's something to fill the time,
yes,
I mean, is there a danger of that coming across in a sort of quality control kind of way?
No, I mean, I'll tell you this. This is the trick. The trick is this. I have written loads of them. And what I do is I tell the audience...
I was going to ask you that. Yeah. I didn't know whether you would have or not.
Of course. Okay. So what happens is I do a couple of my own before I start the interval. And then I say... right, this is my ultimate one, whatever my ultimate one is that night. See if you can top it over the interval, make it a bit more of a challenge. And people jot them down. I get like hundreds, like, you know, obviously. And the tour manager and me, we have a little look through. And most of them are when you go to the toilet and there's no toilet roll.
That is it's like doing a joke competition in a comedy club. Yeah. You've just got to look through them beforehand and go bin, bin, bin.
So what I do then is, and what I've got is about 12 or 13 of ones that I've that either previous audiences have written that are really funny, or ones I've written myself that I know I've got a bit of material about. So I've got one. So I had some stuff about a bus driver that's not quite. It's funny, but it's not funny enough to go, "Oh, bus drivers," and then go into a bit about bus drivers. But if you're doing it, you know, so it sounds almost spontaneous that you've gone, "Oh, I'm just going to do my bus." Oh, I've got a bit about bus drivers, funnily enough.
Okay.
And that way you can sort of, it's like a Derren Brown technique, effectively.
Sure.
What you do is I do this. I really shouldn't be telling everyone.
Well, I was going to say, are you comfortable telling us this?
I'll tell you anyway.
It's a fascinating insight.
It's interesting anyway.
It'll
be fine. No, it's fine. I'll tell you what happens. So what I go on tour and I say, right, I'll pick three or four. I mean, I use quite a lot every night, the funny ones. I'll use five or six of the audiences that night. And I'll go, "Sarah, where's Sarah?" And she'll put her hand up and I'll say, "Sarah says this." And I'll read out Sarah's and it'll get a little giggle off, and it's a local reference or something, you know, so it's always going to be get an extra laugh. And then I'll go and I'll do a little joke off the back of it if I can think of one. And then Phil, "Oh, we got Phil. Where's Phil?" And Phil's at the back and he puts his hand up. And basically, after you've done those two, none of the others need to be in the room because people just think they're all in the room.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So what I'll do is I'll mix it, you know, so then about 10 in, I'll go, "David, where's David?" And there's David, you know, so I'll just mix it up a little bit, you know. So it's a way of just getting them, I mean, I'm quite honest about it in the Edinburgh show because the audience haven't written any of them.
Yeah, sure.
Because there's no interval.
Oh, well, but I think in the Edinburgh show, you said these are ones that previous audiences
have
written.
Yeah, so most people are funny. Everyone can be funny once. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
everyone in the audience there is trying to work out whether they've had their go already.
But, you know, so people do say funny things. And I'm not one of those comics. Like, if someone heckles me and it gets a laugh, I don't try and top it. Like, I think, fine. If you got, I think, for me, I think, well, I made that possible, like that laugh possible.
Sure.
So I don't get, I'm not in that sort of competitive way, but I think I don't worry about that so much.
The fact that you're so open about this now, which I really sort of appreciate, I just wonder, is that because part of what they're, some or all of what they're here for is just to see you, to see your personality because you've got an attractive personality, or to see you because you're a bloke off telly? You know what I mean? It's like if you're kind of effectively like some of those things are kind of like you say to kill a bit of time.
Mm.
Is there an issue there whereby that's all right to do that because they're here to see whatever you decide to do?
No, I think you know, you've seen the Jerry Seinfeld documentary, the comedian, and there's a bit where he's chatting to a New York comic. I can't remember his name now.
Orny Adams.
No, a good one. And he says...
you should totally see that DVD.
Yeah, it's great. It's brilliant. Brilliant DVD. Great insight. I watch it before I go on every tour. It just settles my nerves. Because I just think, well, if Jerry Seinfeld's struggling, it's okay. Do you know what I mean? Like, so And he says to an American comic, he said, because he goes on stage one night and this couple are talking in the front row. And he's in this little comedy club, like there's like 80 people in. And Jerry Seinfeld genuinely looks at this couple and goes, who needs to turn up here? Like, I'm Jerry Seinfeld and you still don't care, you know, and he's really offended by it.
Yeah.
And the guy says to him afterwards, he went, look, it doesn't matter who you are. Like, it's comedy. You could be Jack Nicholson, one of the most beloved love men in the world when it comes to entertainment. And he gets 5 minutes grace.
Yeah.
You know, who I've seen it. I've introduced Chris Rock, Eddie Izzard, hundreds of people who've come up to do a little gig at the Comedy Store when they've been in town. They get 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ain't funny after 5 minutes, they're like, oh, I've got to go on. Like, people don't care that much. You know what I mean? And certainly if they've paid 20 odd quid to come and see you. So the pressure and the jokes have still got to be there. Don't get me wrong, that, you know, they're turning up because it's you, but they're staying and coming back to the next tour because they enjoyed themselves. Mm. It doesn't matter how much TV you do. If they've experienced a bad show, then
sure,
that's false economy. So,
it's a good point. We've only got a few minutes left, and normally I like to sort of ask for questions from the audience. If anyone has any burning issues, feel free to put a hand up. There's other stuff I'd like to cover. So while you have a think, I'll ask another couple of questions.
No worries, I'm in no rush.
So one of the things, your decision when you went on to the one show was sort of surprised me, I think, some people on the comedy circuit, because you're like, well, Jason's a comedian.
What are you doing
being a presenter?
Yeah, it was,
Though you were very suited to it.
I mean, again, it was one of those things where you just think, well, I've got to work, you know what I mean? Mm. And if it's inside, then you're winning, aren't you, you know?
Did any part of you sort of feel that you might be that process you talk about of having the meetings with BBC and ITV when they say what you can and can't say? Mm. Did that ever offend any kind of comic sensibility for you, or were you just happy to be there working?
No, I mean, I do a little bit in my set about offending people on the one show. I think I got 147 complaints once, and for a little joke that I did, and they sort of asked me to apologise. I was like, no.
And I remember, I don't know which of the end of that story, how much of it is true, but they asked you to apologise, so you went on and did a sort of joke apology.
Yeah, that's the bit that I've added for the show. I suppose over the years you develop, you know, you get to a point. I mean, I did a show called Tonightly years ago on Channel 4, and it was very much... comedy by committee. You know, it was a real, like, there was so many fingers in pies. There was so many people saying, this, you should say this. No, you can't say that. Get this person on. By the time we got on screen at 11 o'clock at night, it was a live show, I was saying stuff that I was thinking, I don't even think this is funny, you know. Mm. And so I learned a big lesson there. And you're always learning lessons, you know. And I suppose I got out of that show was, look, if you've got, like Ricky Gervais with The Office, right, Peter Kay with Phoenix Nights, if you've got a vision, if you've got an idea for something and it's yours, and people have trusted you to do that, then you need to be forceful and you need to say no. Like, look, I'm the one who has to say this. I'm the one who gets a flat. No one's writing a bad review over a producer. You know what I mean? No one's writing, or something was edited bad. You know what I mean? It is you who's getting it in the neck. And so that was a big lesson. And again, the one show, I suppose, for me, you know, at the time, it seemed like a good idea. Like, it just, you know, it seemed like, well, this is a way of taking my job to the next level, and getting people to come and see us in the tour I did before that. I think I sold, 22,000 tickets, something like that. The tour I did after that, I sold, nearly 200,000 tickets. So in that respect, it didn't do us any harm. In that respect, I suppose, I didn't necessarily enjoy... The regular, sat there, sort of. I enjoyed working with Alex, and I enjoyed some of the subjects, but it was hard, and it was harder than I thought it was going to be. I just thought it was just professional reading.
And did you think
it was actually some work involved,
And talking of getting it in the neck, when that did end, when it all went kind of tits up, did you feel that you were hammered by the press more than you would have been just as a comic?
Oh, yeah, because it's BBC, innit? So, and also, again, like I was saying, Louis C.K. And some of the stuff that you would talk about on stage, some of the stuff you talk about on stage in the clubs is a million times worse than anything, But if once you're in that world of BBC and stuff like that, you've got to start, abiding to those rules, But it was a tough time, I suppose, and it was detrimental. Like, it was a real tough... It's hard enough being a comedian away from home and your family and stuff, but I mean, I think I was there 5 nights a week, and then I was on tour, 2 or 3 nights a week. So suddenly, you think, actually, my life is mapped out for the next next year, you know, and it was it was tough. You know, there was a lot of depression and all sorts of things. It was a real horrible time, really, you know. So you know, and a lot of them were symptoms rather than causes, but it was tough. And again, you know, you come through stuff and you get to the other side and you go, when you're in the middle of it, you think, ah, oh, this is it. You know what I mean? I'm just going to have a little look at the nearest bridge or something. Off I go, like. But, you know, when you come out to the other side, you think, oh, well, nobody died, did they? It'd be all right. It's only jokes. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, in that respect, I think I'm glad I did it for the experience. And certainly now when I do live telly, you know, there's a lot of producers who are like, oh, you'll be all right. You come and do this show. It's live. You know, when we did our show together and the final was live,
sure.
You know, I don't have any, there's no sweat pouring down the back of my back. I just think, you know, it's fine. You know what I mean? It's live telly, so I've done it before. I'll do it again.
Okay, we've probably just got a minute for one question.
Go on,
if
then.
Anyone has a burning one. If not, I've got one. But no, that's was that? Are you subtly? That was brilliantly subtle. Well done. Okay, go for it. I'll just repeat it through for the mic. What's it like having your younger brother doing comedy?
Colin, yeah. Well, he's here.
He's here. I wasn't going to point that out unless you did.
I mean, he started about 3 or 4 years ago. He fancied doing it. And it's an odd one because with, you know, like I was saying before about it not being accessible, the job being like out of reach of normal like ideas when you were a kid, because you're related to someone who does it,
you suddenly go, hang on, this is a thing.
This is a thing that's doable, you know. And he's a funny lad and he'd done the same sort of, you know, he's into the same things as me, drama and messing about and all that sort of stuff. So he naturally wanted to go. And at first it was a bit weird, and I think he acknowledged that, and he changed his surname, and you know, and so people didn't think he was just, you know, it was nepotism. And I have literally never helped him. Like, I've never rung a club, I've never rung an agent, I've never rung a TV person, I've never helped him, and he's never asked for my help. Like, it's very separate, and we talk about gigs and stuff like that, and he comes along to mine sometimes and I go and see his. But I just thought it was really important that if you want to make it, then you've got to just make it by yourself, like I did, you know. So but he's yeah, he's a funny boy, like, so. But he won't ever be as good as me, like, so. I hope.
I would love to talk more. There's loads of other stuff. There's stuff about Show Me the Funny. I'd love to have that conversation with you sometime. Yeah, but maybe the best, less said the better. Loads more, but we are out of time, and there's a magician needs to come in next. And you know what bastards they can be. So just for now, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Stu. Please join me in thanking Jason Manford.
Lovely. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
So thank you to Jason. I really enjoyed that. Thank you to James Lowy and Anthony and James from So TV. You can get in touch with me, remember, info@comedianscomedian.com or tweet @ComComPod. You can donate on the website. And remember, if you can't afford to donate, then a 5-star rating on iTunes will suffice. Or simply share the show on Facebook or social media, or press it into the greasy palm of someone who you think might enjoy it. Last thing, there are two things that strike me about the comedian listeners to this show as opposed to the non-comedian listeners, the hacks for cash. One, you spend a lot of time driving. I know that's where a lot of you listen to the show. And two, you don't like donating to podcasts, regarding yourselves as having a guest ticket. Totally understandable. Here is a joint solution I'm just going to spend 30 seconds on, and people who listen to a lot of podcasts will probably know what's coming next. If you go to audible.co.uk/cc for Comedians Comedian, audible.co.uk/cc, you can sign up to a free trial of an Audible account for 30 days, totally free. And as an incentive, they give you a free audiobook. And you can even cancel your account if you decide to, and you get to keep the audiobook. Amazing. So if you've got like a 14-hour drive coming up, you can download the Alan Partridge audiobook, for example, read by Steve Coogan in character as Partridge, which is just superb. I know several comedian friends of mine have listened to it many times through. It's got a joke roughly every 15 seconds, and I bloody love it. It's so, so funny. So why not download that if you haven't heard it already? And if you remember to put the CC on the end of the web series, then they send me some sort of incentive as well. I'm going to have to assume it's a small donation at no extra cost to you. So do that, please. If you're thinking of downloading an audiobook, why not try it through a way that helps out this show? audible.co.uk/cc. That's your lot. We're back next week with another one. Might be part two of Sarah Millican. I'd say Sarah was cruelly overlooked at the Comedy Awards recently, but to do that would be to buy into the concept of awards, and that way lies madness. So it might be the wonderful Sarah Millican, might be Rob Delaney. You'll just have to wait and see. Bye for now.
Hi, Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.